Welcome to Fisherwomen. I'm Katie Osborne. Today we are returning to the lower 48, to the Methow River watershed, which lies along the eastern flank of the Cascades in north-central Washington. The Methow River's 80 miles snake through national forests and wilderness areas before joining up with the Columbia River. In the summer of 2014, lightning strikes in the Methow Valley started the Carlton Complex fire. It burned over 250,000 acres, making it the largest single wildfire in Washington state history, and breaking a 112-year-old record for amount of land burned by a single fire. The following year, in 2015, the Okanagan Complex of fires burned even more land, over 300,000 additional acres, just east of the Carlton Complex. Stories like these have become all too familiar across the American West in recent years, where a warming climate and over 100 years of fire suppression have contributed to extended fire seasons and increased fire severity across the western states. Growth in housing at the wildfire-urban interface has also increased the lives claimed and property damage caused by wildfire. But there's good news, too. A way to partner with wildlife to bring back our vital riparian habitats and help our ecosystems recover from drought, erosion, and wildfire. I am speaking, of course, of the beaver. Here we have the North American beaver, Castor canadensis, and in Europe, China, and Mongolia, there's the Eurasian beaver, Castor fiber. My guest today is Alexa Whipple, Project Director at the Methow Beaver Project. She'll be sharing how and why restoring beaver to the landscape can improve the health and resiliency of riparian habitats, a solution so promising that groups are popping up on both North American coasts and across the Atlantic to help restore beaver populations. And a note on the sound in this episode, Alexa was having her roof repaired, so it bleeds into some of the interview. I hope you'll stick with it. Alexa, thank you so much for joining me. To start things off, there's increasing awareness that beaver trapping negatively impacted the arid West in a variety of ways. So continue that story for me. How did beaver removal alter the landscape, and what was their distribution historically?
It's becoming more clear that besides South America and Africa, beavers were pretty much across the landscape, the terrestrial landscape. We have our trapping and explorer records from Lewis and Clark and way before them that showed what a watery landscape the West was when the first white people walked through it, and they couldn't walk very easily through it. It was a pain to get through these systems. Honestly, that was the first thing that happened here was removal of beavers. And that was over by the end of the 1800s throughout our watershed, the Upper Columbia watershed. That was over, and people started moving in and using the landscape that the beavers had once occupied. So even when beavers started to make a comeback, humans were already in that space that beavers would have naturally occupied, and so they became a pest. And so beavers have been kept out of the system because they naturally want the same places that humans moved into once beavers were gone, and that's the floodplains where the soil is rich. And you can grow, in our area, alfalfa or apples or anything for a short while, at least until you take up all the nutrients out of that soil system. But that's the for the arid West, the floodplains around our aquatic systems are the place to be if you want to eat. I mean, the aquatic system still is, you know, a great place to find salmon and other food resources. But if you want to grow food, vegetables, fruit, that's the place to be. So beavers had a hard time moving back in even once humans weren't trapping them for their fur. So we still have quite a small population of beavers on the landscape in the West because of that competition for the same space. And humans win that competition pretty much every time.
That is very true, and thank you for that illustrative answer. We know that only 2% of the landscape in the West remains riparian, yet those areas provide essential ecosystem services and habitat for a diversity of species. And we have estimates that 95% of the riparian habitat in Western North America has been altered, degraded, or destroyed due to human activities such as agriculture, grazing, water diversions, urbanization, and the exclusion of beavers from the landscape. How does that loss in riparian habitat interact with our increased wildfire risk? And what trajectory do you see us on regarding our riparian habitats?
We are speeding up the drying out of our entire landscape. So I started to see even riparian systems that looked lush and wet were burning in these fires. And that's not been reported very often in the research I have done. So I was pretty overwhelmed by the impact of those fires and how they destroyed even the wettest areas that we had on the landscape, but also the scale of removal of vegetation. And then the rain, we had incredible convective storms, so very powerful storms that rained down upon these barren, burnt landscapes and pulled all that sediment off of the terrestrial surface into the streams and created incredible incision. Just within a few weeks after those big fires in 2014, the Carlton Complex. And then I was like, oh my gosh, how is this going to recover? Like when you get a lot of rain on a landscape that's been burnt, especially in an arid environment, you have a lot of damage being done on an already impacted landscape from agriculture, mining, livestock. The challenge now is that we've modified those systems so tremendously, even without fire, that when fire comes through and
burns remaining riparian zones, you get incredible erosion and degradation of the stream channel, which can be compounded by rainfall, as Alexa described. The result is an incised canyon-like channel that fast flows will continue to deepen until it reaches bedrock. The river or stream is essentially stuck in a rut that doesn't allow the waterway to evolve over time as it would normally. Rivers and streams are naturally dynamic. They flood and migrate, back channels become blocked at one end and turn into sloughs, pools fill in and become alcoves, and so on. Fish and wildlife have adapted to the diversity of habitats this creates. Pools of deep, cool water, slow shallows where young fish can shelter, fast riffles where insect prey are abundant, and seasonal wetlands in the floodplains, where regular flooding replenishes soils, making them fertile and productive. With sufficient time, an incised channel will widen, creating what's called an inset floodplain within the widened incised channel, and the stream will slowly build itself back up to reconnect with the floodplain. But this could take tens of thousands of years. In the interim, the water has dug itself a hole it cannot jump out of, even during high flows, and the incised channel will convey water quickly and efficiently across the landscape. We can't afford for time to solve this problem for us because
our landscape did not evolve with efficient conveyance of water. Incised channels convey water very efficiently. Our landscape, at least in the arid West, which is where I study these things, it was used to seasonal inundation, long term, you know, months long of inundation of floodplains from high flows, whether that be in the southwest from monsoon systems or in the northwest from snow-driven systems, so snow melt. Most organisms require water for some portion, if not all, of their life. So for us to not allow water to be stored on the landscape very well at all anymore, we are basically speeding up the disappearance of a lot more species than we already were.
That is certainly a call to arms. Now, I don't want anyone to think that fire is the enemy, because these ecosystems have evolved with fire. We know that low-intensity controlled burns are one of the best tools in our belt for improving forest health while reducing the risk of high-intensity, devastating fires like the ones we've seen across the West this past year. So I want to take a brief detour and ask, in spite of the devastation caused by the Carlton Complex fire, in spite of the massive erosion event, following the storms afterwards, did you see any benefits in the aftermath of the fire?
So after the fires, the native species came back tremendously strong and full, because what I could barely see of native species there before were sitting in wait, lying in wait with their perennial root systems. And when fire burned back the annual invasive species, the perennial root system just went nutso with the ash, the nutrient improvement from burning, and the light that they were able to receive again. And so fire does tend to stimulate native vegetation, and then beavers tend to manage for the foods that they prefer, that it really is a good winning combination. Like after fire, you can actually have a place that was in pretty poor shape. If it has this underlying native community, you could have it come back better than it was prior to fire.
That is so cool. Sounds like a real 1-2 punch to bring back native plant communities in the riparian zone. So before we go any further, what would you like people to know about beaver?
Beavers are not aggressive. They will defend themselves if cornered, but we've been handling beavers for 12 years and over 400 beavers moved. One has bitten through our beaver bag. No one has been bitten ever. They are not aggressive. Their main response to aggression is to play dead. And the one other thing is that beavers do not eat fish. So many people think that beavers are decimating the salmon population, you know, where they are living in the same place. Not true at all. They are strict herbivores. They eat a lot of different types of vegetation, but they are strict herbivores. They are incredibly adaptive creatures. Once you start to learn more about them, you realize how similar they are to humans and our social structures, and how we love to build our environment to suit us better. I mean, we are very similar to beavers in that way, in so many ways.
Nicely said. So back to your story. What was the moment you realized that beavers could be an important part of the solution to recovering riparian habitat in the aftermath of a major wildfire?
So when I saw that the Medhow Beaver Project had put beavers in a burned stream that's in my backyard about 3 miles away from where I live, they put beavers back into a low gradient section of a stream called Bear Creek. And those beavers started working on surrounding a spring with a dam first. They started taking advantage of those low power flows to start storing water. That was in 2015. So what I saw there was them building off of what they could, because they're incredibly adaptive, a spring. And what I saw was vegetation starting to really come back around that water storage area. And when I started seeing that area just holding water and plants really starting to grow again, native plants, it had been a lot of introduced invasive species with the grazing that had been occurring. It gave me so much hope. I went to our Forest Service and range managers and was like, what are we going to do about these incised channels? You know, what about the beavers? And they're like, well, you know, the Beaver Project's working on this stuff, but it's such a large scale impact. It's just going to be time. And people aren't studying beavers so much after major degrading events like this yet. So yeah, I decided I was going to do some research, go back to school, try to show if beavers are truly making an impact and changing incised channels, which I found that they do for sure. And they do end up so cool. They do end up crossing into these incised channels slowly. Like they need to get a foothold first, and then they start repairing those channels.
That is so cool and so great that you just saw a need for research and went for it. And to go back further in time, how did you become interested in restoration ecology more generally and decide that this was the field you wanted to work in?
I had a circuitous route getting to this point. I finished my undergraduate degree at Virginia Tech studying wildlife science. I studied songbirds, wolves, did a lot of different jobs when I was a field tech for that first 10 years, and ended up working on an agricultural study where we were looking at how wildlife was impacted by agricultural chemicals. And that led me to wanting to know a lot more about sustainable agriculture and how agriculture could occur with wildlife, benefiting wildlife and not just displacing or injuring them. So I kind of switched gears from wildlife biology or wildlife science into sustainable agriculture. In that time, you know, wetlands or water are such the critical common ground that wildlife, that humans, that a great majority need fresh water at some point in their lives. So riparian areas just became more and more important to me in understanding how humans could live with wildlife and agriculture, especially in the arid climates of the arid West, take a lot of water from an already limited resource. And we've lost a lot of our riparian areas in that process. So living in the arid climate that I do and growing food and trying to be really conscientious of wildlife, it really blew my mind when these extreme large-scale wildfires raced through back 6 years ago, the rural-urban interface. It really hit home after living here for 14 years, having seen big fires or fires growing in scale in a wild environment nearby, when they, 10 years later, came right into the human-developed environment. It was really shocking to see how delicate our ecological systems truly are when they are affecting you firsthand. And I think it's a great eye-opener, an unfortunate one, that we can't see that far in advance typically as humans, even though we're very observant. But that's where ecology comes in. As my professor at Eastern Washington University, Becky Brown, so clearly stated to me, it's elaboration on the obvious.
Love it. And honestly, it reminds me of when I met you presenting your graduate research at a conference. And it was just such a hopeful message in a space that's so often filled with bad news. And I had never thought of partnering with Beaver to restore riparian zones, never even considered it. And yet, once you presented your work, it just made so much sense that beavers could have this incredible benefit to the watersheds they're in. So, for the audience, could you describe your master's research and what you were trying to find?
Basically, the inspiration to my research was seeing Bear Creek recovering with beavers put into the system by the Met How Beaver Project. So then I studied several others that looked similar and looked totally different as a control areas of non-beaver burned systems. I studied three different aspects of what the beavers' impacts were. One of them was the channel morphology, other was water quality, and the third was vegetation diversity or communities, vegetation communities. So what I found around channel morphology was that beavers are starting to accelerate the stream evolution process. What we found were that they were creating inset floodplains in these deeper incised channels. So basically, they're starting to create structure in those systems that then slows water down and starts the erosion and aggradation process. So you're taking that narrow channel, and by putting some structure in there, in this form, a beaver dam, or even felled trees, where beavers are just felling trees or taking advantage of felled trees and adding more structure to them, it's starting to slow water down and then bounce water off that structure. That bounced water bumps into the edge of the incised channel. It starts to take some of that sediment away from the edge of the channel. It widens right there because of removing that sediment. That sediment then moves slightly downstream until it bumps into something else, slows the water down, and that sediment drops out. That's what creates a bar in a system. So you're basically with structure, and it doesn't have to be beavers, but I was looking at beavers. With that structure they create in the streams, it starts to increase that process of erosion and aggradation, which widens the channel and starts to raise that stream bed again in some places. It creates deeper pools in other places, but then starts to raise that stream bed in others. So eventually you're hoping for reconnection with the floodplain by bringing that channel elevation back up again, like where it might have been prior to its incised state. That's how streams used to function. They had extremely redundant beaver dams across the entire watershed. So you had dam after dam after dam slowing water down, and when water slows down, it really dissipated flooding across our landscape.
Yet another benefit of beaver: increased resiliency of riparian systems to drought and fire, and reduce flood risk. So I know you've seen ongoing benefits to beaver presence in your thesis study systems, because subsequent graduate students at Eastern Washington have continued the work. And they're seeing beavers start to move from these stream-adjacent springs into the deeply incised channels themselves. So what I want to know is, how have the lessons from your research informed your work at the Metau Beaver Project?
One of the things that was really important in that research is that you can't expect beavers to build a dam across a channel that has such high stream power that it's going to blow their dam out every year or a couple times a year. Beavers will get, generally, you'd expect them to get tired of that. The Beaver Project's work has shown of relocating beavers over 12 years, they don't always stick around in areas where they're not finding success. So high in the watershed seems to make the most sense. You'd have the least stream power there up in the low order streams in the high watershed that's been burned or impacted by livestock or mining or roads. And that's where the Beaver Project, the Metau Beaver Project, put conflict beavers for many years, is up in the high watershed. But what we didn't truly understand is that beavers need each other, and if they have to travel long distances to find another beaver, if they lose a mate to predation, they have a long way to go when they're up in a low order stream, because there aren't beavers across our landscape. They're primarily in our main stem rivers and their bigger tributaries, where they can move around and they're not building as many dams. So moving them up into the high country without beavers in between, or good habitat in between their denser populations in the river and all the way up into the low order streams of the headwaters, we're not finding a tremendous amount of success of beavers being able to establish and stick around to start expanding from those areas and repairing the streams from top down. Ultimately, what we discovered for combining the Metau Beaver Project's experience and my research on how beavers really get into a degraded system is that we need to really focus on coexistence with beavers where they are denser in population numbers, and then start working on restoration of incised and degraded channels from the bottom up. And private lands are difficult to work in, but if we have incentive programs to help private landowners, which we should, if they're making a sacrifice for wildlife that benefits the community, there should be incentives for that.
Absolutely. Couldn't agree more. So basically, instead of thinking we can just drop beavers off on public lands in the high country where they're out of the way, we need to allow them to disperse from the valleys where they're already present and use the natural source population to our advantage, rather than thinking we can create new source populations by introducing beaver pairs to headwater streams where they will be isolated and vulnerable. So I understand that it has to be coexistence, but that can also create conflict. What are you doing to facilitate that coexistence with beavers?
I think the first place it always has to start is education and listening. And to be heard is to be open to other ideas. If you can have someone thoughtfully listen to you about what your priorities are on your land, and then say, well, how can we work with you? Here are some of the benefits you might experience by living with beavers. Are those more valuable than potentially the view shed you might have? Being able to explain a little bit more about the ecosystem approach and the benefits that beavers can provide, and how we can prioritize the values that the landowner has at the same time, I feel like is one of the best places to start. And then talking about cost sharing, you know, that you're not in this alone. You don't have to bear the full brunt of the expense of coexistence. Now we're offering education to start with. We offer monitoring to see like the different wildlife that is being brought into the area. And a lot of landowners are just like, oh, I didn't realize what a benefit they were to so many other species that I want to see more of. And so many people, you know, the deer, the mule deer around here are a huge attraction, and they're important on the landscape, but also cougars and bobcats. And people are so excited to see the diverse array of wildlife coming to a beaver complex.
You know, all this talk of coexistence with beavers raises the question, how well do beavers coexist with fish? Beavers build dams, which are typically considered bad for fish passage and salmonids. However, beaver dams were part of the landscape long before people came along. Beaver dams today increase the diversity and complexity of habitat available to salmon and other fishes. This brings us back to one of the key points from our last episode, where I talked with Sarah O'Neill about the importance of diverse, complex habitats for salmon in Bristol Bay watershed. Salmon have evolved with diverse habitats that have selected for genetically diverse populations that are resilient to the natural dynamism of wild ecosystems. For salmon, beaver ponds provide the slow-moving water habitat known to be preferred by salmon smolts rearing in rivers and streams. Studies have shown increased production of salmon smolts rearing in beaver ponds. Additionally, research has shown that beaver ponds provide critical overwintering habitat for coho salmon, which are listed as endangered in much of their historic range in California, Oregon, and Washington. In the Pacific Northwest, most of the loss of coho salmon production has been attributed to the loss of beaver pond habitat. After all, salmon and beaver are hardly strangers.
Because they co-evolved for thousands and thousands of years. Salmon have incredible abilities to jump over these dams. There's that saying, the beaver taught salmon to jump.
Which is a great saying. There is great potential for beaver to accelerate stream evolution, allowing riparian areas to recover more quickly from drought, erosion, and wildfire. Beaver building activities can also increase the amount of woody debris in the system and the amount of optimal rearing habitat, both of which benefit fish. That said, there is potential for beaver dams to block fish passage, especially in our modern landscape. That's why it's also important to remember that these are managed systems. So just as biologists can come in and fence off highly valued large trees on a property so that beavers don't fell them, those same folks can also come in and install structures to facilitate fish passage if a dam is deemed to be blocking migration. Now back to Alexa, as she gives an example of how the Methow Beaver Project is working with a landowner to facilitate coexistence with beaver.
We're getting into our first coexistence cost share with an irrigation district here in the Methow Valley. So we are helping them try to live with beavers by protecting a human-made dam that is a water storage lake for agriculture downstream of there. So what we're going to do is fence the dam to protect it from burrowing rodents, because the beavers have built a bank lodge near the dam, and we want to prevent them from building or expanding into the dam face itself. Because if we do that, they definitely have to be removed. They've been removed from that system in the past.
And you want to avoid that happening in the future, because now you're trying to emphasize coexistence and keep removal as a last rather than a first resort. So this leads to my last question. Here you are, you're choosing sites where beaver can persist, you're fencing off trees, protecting culverts, and undertaking other actions to allow for coexistence with beavers. And you're even building mock beaver dams, beaver dam analogs, so that beaver can move into some of these areas where they maybe couldn't move in otherwise. So why is that effort all worth it? What do beavers deliver that simple human ingenuity cannot give us?
Well, it's a dynamic system that needs to be able to respond to change. We're trying to add structure in a way that improves the natural processes that function on the landscape that respond positively to dynamic events, such as flooding, such as seasonal runoff, such as fire and debris flows. so many of these things can be addressed with complexity and the redundancy of complexity that beavers do offer naturally. We don't have to pay them. We just have to put up with them. And yes, it can be inconvenient. It can be messy. But that's what gives it the resilience that it needs. Water and complexity are what give this whole system resiliency. We need complexity and we need water. And beavers offer that in a way that we cannot really pay for with human activity over time. And our concrete, our chains that tie these structures down and try to make them into a static structure in a dynamic environment, they don't last.
So true, and all excellent points. Thank you. Do you have any closing thoughts you'd like to share with the audience?
If we can change our own behaviors around coexisting, around being patient and sometimes being inconvenienced, and sometimes having to do a little extra work, the benefits will pay off exponentially. But I will say, as much as we say about natural processes restoration, we can't just walk away from them after we put beaver in or we put BDAs, beaver dam analogs in. These systems need management. And if it's not for anything else but managing people, then that's what it needs. Even on public lands, we have a lot of different uses. To access those places require roads. Some of those roads then have culverts. Those culverts are going to get dammed by beavers. We put in a culvert protector. Great, but that's going to need repair in a 10 or 15 years, even if it's functioning perfectly. Humans cannot ever walk away from the systems that they're living in, trying to restore, trying to maintain. It is a maintenance agreement that we need to make with the earth. It's complex, but we know how to do this. We can manage complexity with complexity. We just have to collaborate, talk to one another, observe, share our observations, and work together.
Alexa, thank you so much for those wonderful and uplifting closing thoughts. And thank you to the MetHow Beaver Project for giving permission for this interview. If you're a landowner and you are curious if beaver could help improve water storage capacity on your land, I've linked many of the growing number of groups in North America and Europe who work with landowners on coexistence. If you're not a landowner, but you'd like to get involved, those groups also have volunteer opportunities to help bring beaver back to the landscape. For folks who want to learn more, I've linked the Beaver Restoration Guidebook for landowners and ecologists, alongside some journal articles and the presentation where I first learned of Alexa's work. Finally, if you're looking for a new read, how about Eager by Ben Goldfarb, or Once They Were Hats by Frances Backhouse? And for those looking for a fun film, I've linked the award-winning 2018 documentary, Beaver Believers. You can also find those links on the website at fisherwomenpod.wordpress.com/episodes. And now it's time for our weekly creature feature. Keeping with our theme of the arid west and moving to the south, this week's creature feature is on desert pupfishes, a diverse group of fishes in the genus Cyprinodon. Mainly found in the American Southwest and Mexico, they're known for living in extreme environments and in isolated populations. There are currently 49 recognized species, 3 of which are extinct. The remaining species are rare and often listed as threatened or endangered due to the small populations and limited geographic ranges. For example, the White Sands pupfish is only found in 2 small streams and 2 pools in New Mexico. Like all members of its genus, it is adorable, with a chubby body, rounded fins, and a wide, blunt head. Adults reach a maximum size of about 2.5 inches, or 5 centimeters. As the name implies, individuals are silvery white color, and males can be slightly bluish. The Quitopaquito pupfish is native to Arizona and Sonora, Mexico. In the U.S., they are only found in the Quitopaquito Springs in the Gila River Basin in Oregon Pipe Cactus National Monument in Arizona. where water temperatures can reach 95 degrees Fahrenheit, 35 degrees Celsius. And the third and final pupfish I'll talk about today is the Owens pupfish, native to Owens Valley in Inyo County, California. Most of their habitat was drained in the early 1900s, and they were believed extinct until an isolated population of 200 individuals was found in 1964. The fish were transferred to 6 protected sites by the California Department of Fish and Wildlife, which monitors and manages the 4 surviving populations. These populations survive extreme conditions and do it in style. Males go from blue-gray to brilliant blue for spawning, though the females keep their greenish-brown. All while surviving desert marshes that are typically oxygen poor and where water temperatures can reach over 90 degrees Fahrenheit or 33 degrees Celsius, and salinities can be more than 3 times as high as in marine environments. Talk about a seriously impressive little fish. And that's the show. Thank you so much for listening, and thanks once again to my wonderful guest, Alexa Whipple. If you would like to learn more about pupfish and you haven't yet subscribed, please do. I'm planning a future episode on the fascinating conservation story of Devil's Hole pupfish. If you've been holding off on submitting a creature feature, consider this your invitation to send one in today. I'm always accepting new creature features, and I love being able to share your fish and invertebrate stories. Information on that can be found on the website at fisherwomenpod.wordpress.com or follow the link in the show notes. For episode announcements and pictures of adorable pupfish, follow Fisherwomen on social media. It's at fisherwomenpod on Instagram and at fisherwomenpodcast on Facebook. The Fisherwomen theme was mixed by me, using sounds sourced from SFX Go, Orange Free Sound, and Free Sound. Cover photo for this episode comes from Alexa Whipple. And I hope you've been practicing your fly cast, because next time we're returning to fly fishing with Richie Jones, who has lots of great fish stories and loves sharing them. Until then, happy fishing!